on the family genealogy of Daniel Polanyi for the oral history program at Youngstown State University. The interview is being conducted at 6811 Lockwood Boulevard in Boardman, Ohio on July the 15th, 1989 at 1 p.m. in the afternoon.
And they just listened to all the BS, or they just pulled it all. The girl's secretary with a computer, and he said it's just information on anything you remember about your parents, like when they first came here, the dates, you know, where they came from, you know, what type of people they are, you know, values.
Well, I don't know the year they came, but I know my mother was 16, and she died in 1967, 91. So what year would that be? In 1967, she was 91. In 1976, she was born. Because that's when she was born, in 1976. And she was 16 years old, so that would be, came here in 1892. And that's my mom. And she landed in our farm.
And mom's name's Kathy Warren, right?
Uh-huh. And then I want to get my father. He died in 1923, and he was 47. So he was born in 1896. Well, I'll start with him.
The louder the better.
Yeah, okay.
You don't have to talk to me.
Okay. My father was Michael Gilligan, one of 10 children of one of 10 children of Michael and Bridget McGarry Gilligan. He came to this country when he was about 18 years old, and he went to New Jersey. He came to this country in 1900 to Youngstown. He came to the country in 1900, coming to Youngstown, Three years later from Jersey City, New Jersey, where his relatives who sponsored him and brought him here. My mother was Catherine Gorman Gilligan. She was also born in County Mayo, Ireland, in the year 1892. She was one of 12 children of Michael and Mary Kane Gorman. She left Ireland when she was 16 years of age. And, I beg your pardon, she was born in 1876. She came to this United States in 1892. And she settled in Youngstown, where some of her brothers and sisters had already settled, also coming from Ireland. And she married Michael Gilligan, who was a well-known contractor at the time, highly respected, and had legions of friends. And they settled down on the east side of Youngstown, and they had four children. The firstborn was John, the second was Mary, the third was Joseph, and the last was Catherine. They lived on the east side until Michael Gilligan, the father, died in August of 1923. He was survived by Catherine, his wife, and the four children. Catherine lived in the same house that Mr. Gilligan built, Michael Gilligan built, with the four children. And those were hard times because in those days there was no food stamps or any kind of relief. She would have to sign her name, her home over to Allied Council Agency, who would then give her stamps for food and clothing for the children. But she refused to do it and said her house meant too much to her and she'd work and would never do that. She raised vegetables and sold them to the grocer. She washed and ironed and sewed and paid off the mortgage eventually, and the First Federal Savings and Loan were very, very generous in allowing her to pay the interest.
How many kids were there?
Four.
I mean, how many kids are your dad's family?
I said in the beginning he was one of ten.
One of ten.
Michael and Bridget McGarry Gilligan.
Okay, did all ten come to the United States? Or?
No. He was survived in 1923 when he passed away. He was survived by three brothers, John, James, and Thomas. They all lived in Ireland. His sister and two brothers, Owen and Mrs. Charlie Hecker and Martin Gilligan, migrated to Ohio and lived in Youngstown their entire life.
What did he do when he first came?
He was a contractor, that's why I said at the beginning. Yeah. See, I'm reading this in the obituary paper when he died. That's where I'm getting this.
What was the name of the committee? Who did he work for?
He was work for himself. In fact, my father had very little education, but he was a gifted contractor. In fact, he hired the little Italian men in the neighborhood who couldn't even speak English. But those were times when they were willing to work hard, and he had the first little Ford truck in the neighborhood. He was a very generous and a very happy man. And he would hire these little Italian men and pay them according to what job. There are still some foundations of buildings that he built way back before he died in 23. And at one time, he was so well known among the rich who were predominantly living on Wick Avenue that Mrs. Arms, who is now the Arms Museum, had him install a driveway from the cars' garages in the back out to Wick Avenue. And he did a beautiful job. And she was a little bit hard to get along with. When he had finished, she would not pay him. She held his tools and his equipment. And the reason she gave was he didn't do a good job. So that was his livelihood. So my mother sent three of us children up to beg her to give us back the tools. She reluctantly gave them to us, but she never paid him. And when Catherine, who was speaking, was in high school, she went by that driveway and it was still there, as good as new. That was the only problem he ever had with anybody, but she was known to be quite frugal and denied him his pay. But he worked and trained Mr. Silvestri how to run the little cement machine that made blocks. Mr. Silvestri later became one of the leading mining and engineering in Youngstown, Upper Grove. my father taught him and the other little fellows. And he would pay them all before he'd come home, and sometimes he didn't have any pay left for my mother. And of course that caused a little bit of a ruckus. But he was very outgoing, loving, loved animals, loved people, and was very witty. He was well, this town was very special.
What, where at on this side?
It was originally Maple Avenue. It is on the, it would be on the Wick Avenue and then the railroad tracks. It started at Wick Avenue at the corner where McBain's funeral home is now. Fred Todd, a local philanthropist, lived there at the time, and Maple Avenue extended across the railroad tracks, across Albert Street, and up to what they called the Sandbank, in those days where now the McGuffey Mall stands. And later years, I don't know the reason, but they renamed Maple Avenue on the east side of the tracks to Verona. That was back in the 1930s or so. And the other side was left Maple, but now it's some other street. Now my mother was a different type entirely. She was used to hard work and widowed with four little ones, and she was more of a silent, in the background type of person. She didn't want to make any waves, she didn't want to impress anybody. She was very religious and taught her children to a love of God.
Now where did they go to church?
We all went to the Immaculate Conception grade school on Oak Street in Youngstown, and we also attended Immaculate Conception church. And that was a elementary school, and when John graduated from the Immaculate, he went to Lincoln Junior High, which is on the east side of Youngstown, on Bruce Street, I believe. When Mary graduated from Immaculate, she had an uncle, Frank Gorman, who put her through Ursuline. It was a 2-year secretarial course. You could get your diploma after 2 years. That was the Ursuline High School on Wick Avenue. It's now been dismantled, and it was a stone building, and when the new high school was built, it was dismantled. Joseph the third one did not graduate from Immaculate because in the eighth grade, he went completely blind because of a vitamin deficiency, B12. So he was 2 years actually blind. I used to take him, we didn't have money for bus car fare then, and I used to take him downtown twice a week to Dr. Hills and Hake, who were then in the Keith Albee building, which is also dismantled now. And he was given injections of vitamin B12, and in 2 years he regained his sight. Not 20/20 vision, but he had to wear corrective glasses, which he did not. Catherine graduated from the Immaculate and went to East High School. That was the year of the Depression. There was just no money for any kind of a private school. And in her final year, which was in 1932, the Depression hit, and I didn't have money for clothes, for the proms and so forth, so I got a little job. I did not receive my diploma from high school.
So you think how did depression affect everyone?
The depression affected us in this way. My mother was...
You can sit back.
No, I think better when I'm like this. I put medicine in it. The depression was very hard, but we were thought, in fact, everybody we knew was in the same boat as we were, so we didn't know any different. The churches at Christmas would invite us downtown to the Paramount Theater, which was on East Federal Street, one block east of the square, and we'd see Santa Claus, and he'd give us one of those little boxes of candy, like the animal crackers came in, and an orange. We would walk. We never rode to school. We never had hot lunches. We would walk to school, walk home for lunch, and walk back, which was a mile each way. And we would walk down there and be so happy with that little bit of a gift. That's the only gift we got. My mother used to hang up four socks, big long socks, Christmas Eve, and there was never anything in them. And we just thought Santa went by us. We never thought anything of it. We did little jobs, like I would babysit for 10 cents a day when I was in my teens. And my brother, Joe, got little jobs in the neighborhood. We were all too young to work and there was no work. So we would play. Boys would make a bonfire at night. And if we would get a potato, we would go out and put in the bonfire. And if there was one kid in the neighborhood with the sled, they shared it very willingly. And this one girl, her mother had a store, and she had skates. And we would share the skates. First time I got on, I couldn't skate, but I wasn't going to lose my chance. I fell, and I went home with two big knees. We had a well in the neighborhood, a spring, rather, where we used to get our water. Delicious spring water. Of course, that's gone.
What most of the people eat, the very impression. Really changed?
Oh, yes. You ate what was...
Too much meat.
They canned. All the parents canned. And my father had relatives in New Bedford, PA, had a big farm. And they would call him down after harvest season, and they would give him smoked hams and things. They had a smokehouse, and we'd have that in the winter. But every fall, my father would take us in his little truck, and we'd go out. We thought it was miles away, but it was only Lansdowne Boulevard, which was all forest then. We'd gather apples and nuts, and we had those all winter. Mm. For the black walnuts, and my mother would put them up, you know, and make applesauce, make apple jelly. Anything that you grew, the parents those days. And there was a wonderful feeling of caring in the neighborhood. If my mother got something, and the woman across the street who had 8 kids didn't have anything, she would share what she had.
What is it about these? Why? When you go back, when you ask people all over the place, you know, where are you from, East Side?
There's a comradeship between the East Side, no matter where you go. In fact, Boardman, Austintown, Poland, any one of these boroughs here is comprised of former East Siders. They cared about each other, they helped, and don't anyone ever say anything about them. They'll stand up and defend them.
Now, were most of the people Catholic, or were most of the people
when my parents moved there, my father built his first home along with the help of a lot of Irish friends who came over from Ireland with him. It was a little frame structure. It was at 1116 Maple Avenue. And it was predominantly Irish at the time. They used to call it Bottle Hill. There was a tavern on the next block, but they never abused it. They would go there for social, just a social hour or so, come home. There was never any abuse to the children. It was caring. It was predominantly Catholic. And then, as the years went on, the Italians moved into the area, and the Irish moved to what they call the Hill, which comprised Bruce Street, Lincoln Park Drive, and they used to call those the Lace Curtain Irish, and the ones back are McGuffey and Maple McHenry. In fact, Bishop Malone's mother lived on the next block, and Catherine McGuire was her name. She knew my mother, Catherine Gilligan, real well. That's the present Bishop Malone's parents. And there was the Finnertys and the McHughes and all Irish.
Did most of them, like even when the Italians ever moved in, did most of the Catholics in the area go to a macro perception?
Yes, because in those days, they got along beautifully, but they resented them using their church, which was the Immaculate Conception, because it was built by the Irish. And the funds, they were scraped together and built. And at that time, Our Lady of Mount Carmel was in existence, and they went there. Most of the Italians. There were two families in the Immaculate when I went to school. Dr. Peter Ross's parents, he's now deceased, he was a dentist. He was the only Italian, and the Contis. And they were the only two Italians. But neighbor-wise, they got along beautiful, they were helpful, they'd share their crops. They were great gardeners. They had fig trees, grapes, and their vegetables. They would share them with my mother and our family. And my mother, if she can, but she canned everything. She started canning, we hated from the end of August till there was no more things on the trees. And
see much discrimination because of being Irish or Catholic?
Did she show it? Did you say?
No. Did you see much discrimination by
The old Irish, generation that came from Ireland, resented intermarriage with anyone but Irish. They did not want their children to marry Italian. That was the only ethnic group in the neighborhood at the time. I don't know whether they would have objected to Germans or what. But on the east side, there was a German. The Germans lived on the what they call Madison Avenue at the time, was later McGuffey Road, and on Bennington. They had the German hall over there. The Germans were settled there. At those days, they used to settle in little clans. When they'd bring their relatives, they'd settle there. Well, when the Italians were coming over in such numbers, their little group, which was up Smoky Hollow, where MBR is, there was no more room. So they migrated over to the east side and blended in with the Irish. And my father got along very well with them. They were hard workers, willing to do anything for very little pay. And my mother's family, she was one of 12. And she died at 91 with all her faculty. She had a slight stroke on April 1st. She maintained a speech and everything till Thursday that week, and she died on April 7th of that. But she could read and write. She had a third grade education. In fact, when I was in Ireland in 71, I visited the area where she lived, and there was an elderly man there that remembered her as a little girl. And he took us to the little village where Guinness Stout is now, has most of the land, and they have these salmon hatcheries they're developing. And this gentleman showed me a bridge that my Uncle Pat, my mother's brother, built way back in the 1800s. It was over a nice little brook. It was still in perfect condition. It was made of brick and the cement walk, and it was curved. And I wish I had taken a picture of it. And this elderly gentleman said he used to make caskets for the dead in the area. He was such a good craftsman. And he put the, my mother's house didn't have a ceiling in it. It was a two-room cottage with a little attached, sort of a garage. It was here, a little building where they kept the cattle in the back. But it had the hearth, and the mother and father slept in bunk beds next to the hearth, and the rest of all those children slept in that other bedroom. And they tell me that when her mother died at 99, if she lived one more month, she would have been 100. And my mother said when they were little, she was very poor, in poor health, and all the neighbors would take the little children and bring them home. But in the winter, when it was cold, she'd bring the little sheep in and the cow and put it in the living room because it was cold. They had a terrific love of nature and animals, both my parents. And this elderly gentleman told me all this. Had a beautiful roof in his cottage because he was the bailiff at the time, and he had pretty good pay. And he had this beautiful lacquer ceiling because they're just all one floor with these cottages. And my Uncle Pat did that. Mr. Frank Gorman had a very responsive job with the New York Central Railroad. And he was a very learned man. He was a school teacher in Ireland. And when his fiance died, he came to America and got this good job at New York Central.
Why do you think most people, why do you think your parents came to America?
I asked this elderly gentleman because there was the lupus and the rhododendrons growing wild. There's no pollution. It's nothing but scenery that you never saw before. The lake across from where my mother lived, she lived on this little cottage, was as blue as the sky was on a clear day, and salmon. That was their food.
Why do you think they would leave that?
And I asked Mr. LaBelle, why did my mother leave this beautiful place? He said, because she was hungry. The older generation were used to cold and stove and no warmth in the winter, just the cold stove, and eating potatoes and they cannot grow any tropical fruit because of the damp climate. It's all imported from New Zealand or Australia, but their cabbage and their greens and their livestock, their lambs and their pigs and their cows, and every house had a big dog, was loved as much as the children. They had separated their lots, not by a surveyor. They'd say, now, you can have this land up to here, put a stone wall on. They get the stones out of the mountains. They used to heat and cook turf, they go out and dig that. It was self-sustainable. The younger, with 12 kids, they couldn't live like that as they grew up. So that's why so many Irish migrated to the Americas. And it's going on now because unemployment is so high over there, wages low. They're leaving. In fact, this beautiful Kerry is just going to be just a tourist attraction. The young can't live on what the parents did, cows and selling the milk. And England was very, very cruel to them too. When England, they'd come for the taxes, and if the people didn't have the money, which they didn't, they lived by the work of their own hands, they would take their best cow or their best pig or their best lamb. There was no mercy shown to them at all. They take that for taxes. And when we were there, we were in this beautiful castle. This was in 1971 we were visiting. And I noticed the construction. We went all through it. And the guide was telling us about different features of it. And I noticed about 4 feet from the top to the original brick was different. It was a different color. And I asked him, why was it different? Was it restored? He said, no. In those days, when there was nothing else for the English to take. If you had a roof on you, you had to pay it somehow. So what they did, they just took the roofs off. Castles, home, and that's when they built the little straw. And the castle, they just put stuff over it. Because that was the English law, that if you had a roof, you had to pay it somehow or be jailed. But they had a hard life under English rule. And Eamon de Valera, I think it was in the 30s when he declared the Irish Free State. But the kingdom would not give up Belfast in the north where all the industry was. And that's what's causing the strife today. They would not give Catholics who lived in that area, could not afford to move out of it. They were treated worse than the garbage men here today. They couldn't get a job with the government. They just were suppressed in every way imaginable. Yeah. And I have some books on that too. What have I covered?
Yeah. What about, let's go to the kids. Let's see when we talk about each kid, like
John?
Yeah.
Who's number one? John was a very handsome man. He was very skilled at baseball. He played for the Eastside Civics, which was a sandlot game. There wasn't too many those days, but Eastside Civics were considered one of the best in the valley. He played the outfield, and he had the skills. But there was something about John. He didn't want anybody to know how good he was. He thought he played it cool, in other words. In other words, if a fly ball came out where he was, he didn't want to catch it, he'd just saunter up to it. But he had the skill. In fact, they wanted him to pursue it, baseball, but he just wasn't interested. But he was a good person. And they were all my mother and Mary and Joe were all down in bed with diphtheria. And those are the days they put the sign on the door, a red sign, you weren't allowed in, you weren't allowed out unless you were along the medical profession. I was 8 years old, I think, at the time, and I took care of them. And the nurse came one day and she says, there's a boy here by the name of John, where is he? Because you could get arrested if you went out germs, you know. And I said, he's down in the basement, he's working. She says, okay. The boys. But he was a very kind person, a very religious person. He served Mass until he was in his late 20s at the Mass. Conception Church, say 11:30 Mass.
So he went to East?
No, Lincoln. He went to Lincoln. Remember I said after Immaculate, he went to Lincoln, junior high.
Oh.
It was 2 years. See, those years you could go 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But he went to Lincoln junior
high. That was all higher he went. Right?
Yes, that was it. So I think it was, he had a Ford convertible, roadster they call them. He got a job in the office with Sheet and Tube Company.
That was right after that? Or?
I'm trying to think what year. My father died in 1933 in the Depression. It had to be about 1929. I think he had a 29 for it. And he was working at the Sheet and Tube office. And then they got laid off during the Depression. I don't know what year he got a job at the Sheet and Tube Mill in Canada, but he worked there until he retired in 1973. I Mary took a 2-year course at Ursuline High School in secretarial. And in her second year, Senator Eugene Roberts and Senator Nils P. Johnson, both deceased now, they used to go to Ursuline to pick out the better scholars. It was an all-girls school. And Senator Eugene Roberts picked Mary Gilligan, my sister, to go to Columbus and be his secretary. And his, also Nils Johnson, used her as a secretary. She was only 17 at the time, never been away from home, but she went down to Columbus. And Mr. Eugene Roberts, he was a native of Hubbard, but he was the senator from this area. He introduced her to one of the secretaries, and she took her to a nice boarding house. And she stayed there for the 2 years that she was in the, working as a secretary to these senators in Columbus. We didn't have any money to go see her. She didn't have any money to come home. So it was all letter writing. So when she came home, that was during the Depression. Things were bad. She got a job in one of the 10-cent stores. And she worked there, and then she got a job with a real estate, Interstate Development Company. They were building a lot of buildings on the east side for the Germans, Mr. Cuddy and Mr. Toski. And she worked there until they closed up. But they let her have the office, and she had notaries. She was a notary, and some days she'd bring home 50 cents a week, some days 75 during the Depression. And Fred Kapp Insurance was on the same floor, and his girl quit. And he hired Mary, my sister, to work in the insurance office. And he paid her, I think, something like $10 a week. And she could keep her notary fees. And she walked back and forth to work, gave my money, my mother all the money, and we carried her lunch. And then she got married in 1933, I believe. So in 1934, she decided that she was leaving home, and I was not working yet. I just did a lot of jobs, babysitting, house cleaning, or sweeping snow. So I went and took a job with Fred Kapp Insurance, and I worked for $7.50 a week, went back and forth to work winter and summer, carried my lunch. We didn't have any coffee breaks those days. You went to the restroom on your lunch hour. And you worked from 9 to 5, 6 days a week. No Saturdays. Is that hitting the door?
No.
And so 2 years later, he raised my salary to $10. Prior to that, I worked in McCrory's, and I got $11 a week the first week. I almost ran home to show my mother I got $11 a week. Walk back and forth, ate our lunch. You used to have to sit on a barrel in the stock room to eat your lunch. That was what we put up with those days. Then. Well, Joe, he got a job at Republic Steel. He had this little odd job helping a man who owned a tavern. He'd do his work like clean up and clean the bar and stuff like that. And then he got a job with Republic Steel. And he worked there until he retired. And he moved to Massillon and married a woman who moved to Massillon. And he died in 1977. John died in 1973. Mary is still living, but her husband passed away in 1983. So the entire Gilligan family of 10 are all deceased, and the entire Gorman family of 12 are all deceased. The two remaining members of the Gilligan-Gorman marriage are Mary Swaggle and Catherine Pamela, who live in Gorman. He automated that a lot. He was brilliant. And he was a roller, and then Tim Gorman, among their brothers, was a roller at the Sheep and Tube, and he married this haughty little Anne Malloy. Her nephew was Jack Gillespie, who was deep.